Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Doug Kelly. I'm here with good friend and co-host Grant Rubin down at State Grant.
Hey, welcome everybody, and happy Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, it's already that time, isn't it? Can't believe how fast this year has gone by. Well, folks, we're glad you were able to join us tonight. We've got Chris Balzano with us tonight, and we're going to be talking about urgent urban legends. Okay, I can talk. Give me a break. Don't laugh. You're laughing at me, aren't you? Okay, go ahead. I'm a funny guy, funny Ned. Anyway, we're going to be talking about urban legends and want to invite you to be a part of this program tonight. You can go into the chat room and ask questions. Join us there if you wish. You can also call in live. The number is there on the screen, 347-945-7799. We'd love to take your questions live. So without any further ado, let's introduce tonight's guests, Chris Balzano. He's a teacher and a writer from the Boston area. He's the founder and director of Massachusetts Paranormal Crossroads, an online collection of legends and ghost stories from Massachusetts and the surrounding states. He has been investigating the paranormal for more than 10 years and has been writing about those experiences for the past five. He has been a contributor to Jeff Ballinger's Encyclopedia of Haunted Places and Weird Massachusetts, and one of the writers behind Weird Hauntings. His writing has been featured in Haunted Times and Mystery Magazine and has been covered by the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald, the Standard Times, and the Wista Magazine. Christopher currently lives in Woburn, is that right, Massachusetts, with his wife and young son. His first book was Schiffer Publishing, Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and the Paranormal in the Freedom State Forest, or Freetown, excuse me, State Forest, is an exploration of one apex of the Bridgewater Triangle and scary things that find their way there. His website is masscrossroads.com. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Doug. Thank you for having me.
And I pronounced it, God, I can't pronounce it.
It's like a rough night tonight.
Hey, it's jet lag. I just got in today. Wista, right? That's correct, isn't it?
Wista, you pronounced it exactly right, Wista.
Yeah, Wista. I've been there. Of course, if you pronounce it phonetically, it's Worcester. But
Worcester, right. So, yeah.
Worcester.
So it's a true meaning if someone's from Massachusetts, bring them along the highway and see if they say, you know, Reading instead of Reading and Peabody instead
right.
of Peabody. And, of course, Worcester's the good one. So.
Yeah, it's Peabody, right? Peabody and Reading, isn't it?
Peabody and Reading.
Yep, that's what I thought. I've been in Worcester several times doing management seminars, so. That's cool. Glad to have you with us tonight. Appreciate you taking the time. So tell us about how you got started in paranormal research.
Well, that all kind of started, I was in college at Emerson College in Boston, and my dorm was the famously haunted Charles Gate Hotel right there in Kenmore Square near Fenway Park. And this is one of the most haunted buildings in Boston. And we experienced a lot of weird and unusual things there. And so I started kind of documenting things, but what really seemed to strike me at that time was not only that the true hauntings were going on, but also these things that were not true, that were being taken just as truthfully as a real ghost story. So what happened was is there were the hauntings, but then the urban legends seemed to attach themselves to the same exact location. And I started saying, you know, well, wait a minute, that's not true. That didn't actually happen. And then someone would, you know, claim it from their highest voice the same way they would claim someone that had, you know, weird things moving in their rooms or lights flashing on and off. And so I started to say, you know, really, there's some kind of connection between urban legends and the paranormal. They kind of come from the same vein, and they're easily people, and then investigators can go back and forth between the two of them. So I started the crossroads as kind of a place to document that kind of thing, hauntings, and then the urban legends, which seem to kind of entangle themselves in them.
That's cool. So, and that was over 10 years ago?
Yeah, that was, you know, unfortunately, I had my 10-year high school reunion last summer. I'm turning 33 tomorrow.
Oh,
and you look back, you say, I've been in this now for 14 years, and my website's been up since 2002, so I've been doing math crossroads for 6 years, and start to, wow, I'm, maybe, you know, there's something to all of this, because it's kind of sustained the momentum since, you know, the first few months of me having it up there. It's kind of, it grows every single month, and more people kind of approach me with their true stories that sometimes end up being nothing more than urban legends. And so, you know, I feel to some degree I'm somewhat of a, you know, a veteran somewhat in the field. So
yeah.
So hey, Chris, do you, when you're doing the research on this, do you like say for instance there's an urban legend and you think that there might be a historical route to it? Do you actually go back and do the research and out of those cases, how many of them actually, you know, you've been able to make a correlation?
I would say that I consider myself a researcher first, a writer second, and an investigator third. So I'm definitely very much into interviewing people, going into town records, finding things like that might actually back up with something you're saying. And I would say I probably find maybe a good 10% have something which may be the cause. I had this haunting, for example, in Denham, Mass., where this man had, when he was younger, which I believe was in the 1960s, had seen this odd woman on his way to his grandparents' house who seemed to be floating above the air and in this white dress. And he watched her, and she was a hologram. He didn't even seem to recognize that he was there, and it really affected his life for, you know, the next 30 years. Well, when he contacted me, he told me the address. I was able to kind of correlate it with this woman who had died while she was wearing a white nightgown right in that same exact area. And the husband had been put on trial because he had killed his wife because she didn't know her place. And then he had dragged her down to the water and kind of washed his hands of her blood and left her there. And it was kind of, you know, this is one of those stories where, you know, was that the woman he was seeing? Maybe not. But it's that kind of 10% that might have some kind of explanation to it.
That's fascinating, because I would imagine in your neck of the woods up there, which is so rich in American history anyway, that there's all kinds of historical records that you can research and really dig into it.
It's interesting. Like, I was investigating this haunted schoolhouse in Newburyport, for example. There's all of these newspaper accounts of it, and yet, A, really hard to decipher old language, whether they're being sarcastic or not sometimes about the haunting. And the other thing is, you get a lot of, you know, Boston may be a metropolitan area, but the majority of Massachusetts is very rural, actually. And so what you have is a lot of rural superstition kind of creeping in. So things would happen, and a great example of that would be in Rhode Island with the whole Mercy Brown vampire phenomenon, you know, where the records are all there, and yet the records are tainted by people who had a certain perspective on the situation. And so they right away, you know, claim that it was ghosts. Or I should say in that case that it was vampires, this other case in Newburyport that it was a ghost. And yet, you know, we have to take the fact that, well, maybe it was kind of, you know, what paid back then would have considered a ghost, which would just be something unexplained. Unfortunately, we can't go back with our equipment and try to capture something there. We have to kind of take these stories. And there's tons of stories like that. For a very long time, especially during the very strong Puritan days of New England and of Massachusetts, there are a lot of stories out there about hauntings that really happened. We have actual court cases, other than the Salem Witch Trial, of course, court cases where people have actually sued the owners of houses because the house was haunted. One example in Plymouth, for example, of a man who actually sued his tenants for defamation of his house because they had claimed it was haunted and he couldn't sell it or get anyone to live there. So all this kind of spectral evidence, which was disallowed, you know, hundreds of years ago, is still there as record. So when you go and you kind of look for the longer, older history, you kind of run into a lot of that rural superstition and kind of Puritan ideas of the devil and things like that.
Yeah, that's not, you know, that when you talk like that, Chris, it kind of reminds me of my old days when I was a college freshman and I had to read Nathaniel Hawthorne. And I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Goodman Brown.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, that it really conjures up Puritan images of pine trees bursting at mid-level into flames and having little reunions with the devil out there. That's got to be so rich in American folklore. It's got to be a real treat for you.
It's interesting because where I work in Lawrence, it's kind of right on the edge of, it's in the same county as Salem, and it's in the same county as a lot of those older places that kind of those stories come from, those great letters come from. So, for example, we're reading The Devil and Daniel Webster, and these are places that, you know, we can identify. These are ideas that come from down the street. When we're talking about the Salem Witch Trial, we could basically throw a rock at Lawrence and hit some of those locations. And so it's very interesting because, you know, modern children or modern students, I should say, have a very different idea of what the devil is. And it's kind of exploring that whole connection between what they used to think and what we think and, you know, are these kind of old stories or is there something more to it? Is a lot of where I get my teaching done when I'm actually trying to teach them things, just metaphors and similes and all that great stuff.
Well, tell us about the Darkwater book. How'd that get started? What's all that connected with?
When I started to first post my research, when I began Massachusetts Paranormal Crossroads, I found that I was continuously being drawn to the same part of Massachusetts, which unfortunately is about an hour and a half away from me. But I kept getting these stories and these tales and these legends from an area southeastern Mass, which is called the Bridgewater Triangle. And the more you kind of write on it, the more people, because, you know, all of a sudden start to think you're an expert, so the more you have to know, so the more research you do. And so I was constantly, you know, I would love a nice Boston haunting where I could have gone down the street and done something or, you know, something close by, but they kept drawing me in there, so I kind of took it where it was going, where it was leading me. And then one day, and the apexes of the triangle are these three towns, Abington, Rehoboth, and then Freetown, which is where my book is.
How big
and
is
Freetown is kind of, what is that?
How big is that triangle of those towns?
About 200 square miles.
Okay.
And I should say that, you know, that was the traditional classic definition posed by cryptozoologist and writer and sociologist Lauren Coleman back in the late 70s and early 80s, and that's how he defined it. And he's told me that, you know, this was basically meant to be a template. So I've expanded kind of what I call the Bridgewater Triangle. I changed what the kind of criteria is for acceptance into the canon of Bridgewater Triangle stories. He mainly focused on cryptozoology, some UFO sightings, a lot of, you know, different odd animals and black helicopters, things like that. But never really looked at the paranormal aspect of it, never really looked at the ghost aspect of it. When I did it, that's the kind of researcher I am. So I always approach the triangle from, what are the ghost stories? What are the legends? What are the ghostly legends that are living there? And so as I started to explore that a little bit more, I kind of pushed the boundaries of what his triangle was, somewhat with his permission, to kind of extend further. For example, he put one of the apexes at Freetown, but Freetown technically used to be Fall River, which is where Lizzie Borden lived, where she committed her murder, or, you know, supposedly committed her murders. That used to be part of Freetown. Parts of Rhode Island used to be part of Freetown. So I thought, well, if he stopped at kind of a natural town barrier, but if you think about it historically, the town he included so much more. So using those kind of criteria, I really kind of began to look at a lot of things that were right on the edge of the triangle and including it. So it probably looks more like a big blob now than a triangle, but it suits me well. So I was just doing that research, and my boss, who's from that area, said, well, have you heard of Freetown? Like, that's got to be the weirdest town out there. And I had never heard of it. And, you know, if I look on a map now, you're not going to be able to find it unless you find one of the larger towns that are near it. So I started doing a lot of research and finding there wasn't a lot of information about it out there on the Internet. So in my typical fashion, I, you know, strapped my gear on and went out there and by my gear and then, you know, a microphone and a notepad and just started kind of taking stories of people that were out there. And then I discovered a man by the name of Alan Alves, who was for a long time a police detective out there. And he was, for all intents and purposes, a small town detective who should have led a very boring life. And instead, there was so much going on in the town of Freetown that he worked on almost 24 homicides during his time in the small town. Mm. And I started, the more I started to dig with that, the more I started to find those stories and weird tales of things going on in the forest, as well as the very odd crimes that he was involved in during his career. This man was actually the leading authority of a cult crime in the United States. That's how much of the weird stuff was going on in his backyard.
Wow.
And from that, all of a sudden, I just started kind of, Schiffer approached me that they wanted me to work on a book, and I said, I've got this really interesting story of this town that no one's heard of, and yet it seems to be this kind of magnet for negative activity, for negative things, and a lot of weird things are going on there. And I think it would be really good because it's part true crime, it's part conspiracy theory, and it's part folk local ghost book. And so I just started digging more, and pretty soon kind of Dark Woods began to take form.
That's really cool. So what are some of the interesting stuff you've come up with for that book?
Well, there are a lot of the main part of Freetown itself, Freetown proper kind of now, is the Freetown State Forest, which takes up more than half of the town itself. And this is a place where there have been more weird crimes and what I call disproportionate crimes. I'll give you an example of disproportionate crime. A lot of drugs run through this section of Massachusetts because it's very close to kind of the coastal cities, New Bedford and Fall River, where a lot of drugs were coming in. So there was a lot of sketchy activity in that area. And so there were these kind of people who were trafficking drugs who came across a homeless man. And in their paranoia, they thought this homeless man was an undercover cop. So they dragged him out to the forest. And now, modern crime or normal crime would tell you that they would take him out there, shoot him, maybe even hang him up as a sign of that they're dominant from their power. Instead, they set the man on fire and let him burn alive.
Jeez.
The whole time with him screaming and then standing there. This is what I call a disproportionate crime. Things happen all across the world. Things happen all across the state. Things happen all across the area of near the Bridgewater Triangle. But it seems in the Bridgewater Triangle, everything gets amped up a little bit. Everything kind of has an unusual twist to it. So something like that would be not a normal thing for people to do, more violent, more kind of explosive.
So that's what you call a disproportionate crime, where it involves maybe more of a heinous element to it?
Right, where something kind of isn't, where people go too far, where it really kind of makes you kind of lose your breath, gasp for that second of just how exactly you said heinous it is.
Okay, cool, interesting.
So how long is the timeline there, Chris? Can you trace back? How far does that go in that particular area?
Well, the really interesting thing is I can trace it back at least 400 years.
Really? The murders and all the crimes that have been going on there that have been of that nature?
Yeah, it's kind of the first thing that hit that area would be right before the arrival of the people on Plymouth Rock, the Puritans on Plymouth Rock. You have smallpox-type disease that wipes out, I believe it was a third of the Wampanoag tribe, who was by far the dominant tribe in that area. Their home is mainly the area that is the Bridgewater Triangle. And you can actually trace the disease to the parts that are not the Bridgewater Triangle, and the tribes were completely untouched.
Wow.
So all of a sudden what you have is this area which, beginning from, they didn't like the area to begin with. Most parts of Freetown, for example, they didn't like it. It was kind of they went there only when they had to, when fishing forced them to. But here you already have the first instance of a tragedy. Then once the Puritans arrive, you have the entire area sold to pass off chief's drinking debt. So already it's kind of, this land is purchased in blood some ways. His name's Massasoit, which is kind of a famous name. It means great sachem. And he is, he's kind of the big, Squanto was under him kind of thing. I mean, these are historical figures. Massasoit's son, Philip, sold the land to pay off his dad's debt because as soon as they came, he really enjoyed his alcohol, and he ran up such a bill that they were forced to sell this huge plot of land known as the Freetown purchase. And then all of a sudden you see weird things happening. You see the signing of that deed, the man who signed it for the Wampanoags, actually a few years later leads to the whole King Philip's War, which was this, once again, take that disproportionate crime to a disproportionate war. It's kind of the forgotten war here in America. It happened before the French and Indian War, definitely before the Revolution. And what you had were Wampanoags and Puritans aligning themselves with what they were called praying Indians, which were Wampanoags who had converted to Christianity. Mm-hmm. And they basically fought. They fought kind of over control, although it's funny, the history books actually call it an Indian uprising. But it was more of just, you know, two groups of people fighting. And you had both the British and the Wampanoags committing the most atrocious war crimes that have ever been seen, kind of, especially on American soil, but maybe even kind of in the history of America. This is a time when British people would go into a village, and not only would they take the men, but they would also take the women, the children. They would burn the entire village, including the elderly and the sick. And then the Wampanoags would do the whole thing. They would hit a settlement, and instead of hitting the settlement, taking kind of the prizes of war and killing the men, they would wipe everybody out. And this went on for almost a year, just absolutely kind of horrible, horrible acts of violence against each other. So even as early as, and that was 1675, even as early as 1675, you're seeing this place have a weird effect on the people that were living there. It doesn't make you evil. It just seems to bring out the worst in you when you're there.
How do you account for that? Do you have any hypotheses for that, or hypothesis?
It's really weird. When the British got here, they had already seen what the Spanish had done down in Florida, for example, and down in South America and Central America, and they were determined to not do that. They were determined to come in here, make friends with the Native Americans, convert as many as they could to Christianity. And so the mere fact that they turn into the very thing that they hate when they get down there actually forces me to say, no, there is an explanation. That's the weird part of it. I can't account for why these people who were very civilized to each other, who sat down at the first Thanksgiving, only a few years later, slit each other's throat at the drop of a hat. And then within the war itself, there's a lot of betrayal. King Philip himself, basically, one of his war generals, I believe, said that he thought they should surrender, that they should give up the war. And in front of his own brother, he killed him. Well, that brother turned around a week later and betrayed Philip.
Huh.
And so there's a lot of instances of these people who are very, very loyal to each other, stabbing each other in the back. You have the same thing upon the surrender that ends the King Philip's War, which happened at Annawan Rock, which is a really great haunted location in Massachusetts. Basically, Benjamin Church said, if you guys surrender right here, we treat you with honor, we treat you with respect, we'll put you on trial, we'll basically say, you know, the whole thing was, you know, you were time of war, you go free. And then without Benjamin Church's knowledge, on the way back to Plymouth, all of the people that surrendered were massacred. So there's a lot of instances of that kind of, it's hard to tell whether it's a chicken or the egg. You know, did that help? Most people say that helps make the area that haunted, and I actually say it's a symptom of just how dark that section of Massachusetts might be.
Hmm. That's interesting because, you know, you wonder what is it about that area or even circumstances or anything that could cause people to act so viciously, so beyond perhaps a normal human capacity to act viciously, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, what I put forth in the book is that for some reason negative energy is trapped there. There's a lot of granite in that area, for example. There's the Taunton River, which runs directly into the ocean. There are supposedly, although I haven't done the research on this, so please no follow-up questions, there's supposedly ley lines that run underneath. So it's kind of like, it almost seems like it's this great petri dish for energy. And somewhere along the line, that energy became negative energy. And so what happens is that negative energy draws negative energy into it and recycles it. Not very scientific of an explanation, and people have kind of put their own scientific twist, talking about the unique properties of some of the rocks that are there, and the water supplies and the running water supplies.
Unfortunately, all that stuff that in terms of the paranormal, in terms of, you know, emotional stuff, can't be proven. But at least, you know, if you go through the time with the stories, it seems that almost as if, you know, weird things find their way to Freetown.
Well, you know, that whole area up there has got lots of granite, Vermont, that whole area, D.C.
New Hampshire is the granite state.
Yeah, New Hampshire. I'm sorry. That's the one I was thinking of. So do you find that that whole area has some of these disproportionate crimes or?
I really don't. I mean, there's an area in Vermont that at least has the paranormal activity, but there really isn't this weird connection, this high level of paranormal activity alongside crime the way that there is in southeastern Mass. And so maybe it's a combination of the different things. A great example of this would be James Cater, who's one of the cases I cover in the book. He committed a crime where he basically tied a woman up and left her to die, and she escaped. And he was put in jail, and he served, you know, part of his sentence. This is Massachusetts, so our criminals get out early. And then he commits almost the exact same crime in a town called Brockton, which is right kind of at the beginning, kind of, you know, just inside the lines of the Bridgewater Triangle. Well, he abducts her, and instead of taking her to any number of places in that area, instead he drives all the way out to Freetown, which is about probably a 45-minute drive from Brockton, passing a lot of really good places to dump a body, and instead commits his crime in Freetown. Depending on which report you want to read, either shoots her to death or leaves her to die hanging in the same exact position. And, you know, this is one of the most famous crimes. He is kind of like the boogeyman of Freetown, only because even though he's been in jail for the past almost 25 years now, the appeal process seems to go on and on and on, and he always seems to kind of be up with a new reason to get a trial and gets one. So that's an example of people finding these crimes, finding their way. The other weird thing we actually found was that it actually has the highest number of juvenile detention facilities, mental health buildings, of the state, and then, of course, it's higher than the national average. There's a higher average of teen suicide in that area. Bridgewater State Hospital, which is kind of this very, I used to work with juvenile criminals, and it was, if you don't do this, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're going to end up in Bridgewater. I mean, it's this kind of menacing building with this reputation of weird things happening there. It has, like, four or five times the suicide rate of its inmates of any place in the entire United States.
Is that attributed to the staff, perchance?
Well, of course, you know, it's always, you know, the conditions there are no worse or no better than any place else. Just for some reason, people seem to lose hope there. And I think part of that is because that's also one of the areas of Massachusetts that has the commitment of, kind of think of what it's called right now, where basically the court says, you served your time, but we still think you're dangerous, so we're going to commit you. Civil commitment. That's where most of the civil commitment patients are there. So there's nothing worse than knowing when you arrive at Bridgewater, you're there for a day to the rest of your life, and we can't tell you when you're going to leave.
Well, so that dashes the hope aspect.
Right.
Big part. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking with Chris Balzano and Dark Woods and the Bridgewater Triangle and lots of other stuff, so hang with us. If you would like to ask Chris a question, you're more than welcome to call in live, 347-945-7799. That number is displayed on the listening screen. There's also the chat room, so if you'd like to go in there and ask a question, you can too. Hang with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Welcome back to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly with Grant Rubenvest, and we're talking with our special guest, Chris Balzano from Mass Crossroads. We're talking about his research and experiences in the Dark Woods book, Bridgewater Triangle. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah, some very interesting stuff you've been talking about, disproportionate crimes that have a perhaps a little more heinous element to them in that whole area. Chris, what are some of the stories that you've uncovered that have led to perhaps some urban legends?
Well, there is no shortage of ghost stories coming out of the forest itself. The first kind of level of ones that I got were people who were seeing a lot of Native Americans within the forest itself. Part of the kind of negotiating, in modern times, part of the forest was reserved as a reservation for the Wampanoag tribe in return for some other land which they needed for political reasons. Excuse me. So what happened was there's this whole area of the forest, which is this very peaceful kind of pocket of land in this very, very weird forest. When you go into the forest, you feel it's heavy. It's funny because when I bring people in there for the first time, they're always kind of chuckling. And then as soon as they get in, they're like, whoa, this place is really heavy. And that's the word that I get, heavy. I get a feeling in their chest. Something they can't explain, you know, with words necessarily. And so this reservation is this kind of little pocket of almost levity in this really dark place. And a lot of ghost stories have come out of there. A lot of people have been in this reservation area, and they've seen almost like replays of events that happened with Native Americans. I have one instance where someone was hunting a deer, and they saw a ghostly deer. They saw the deer get hit by something they couldn't see, and the deer fall to the ground. And then when they went, they kind of like, I've got a camera. I'm going to take a snapshot of that. It disappeared. Only kind of replay itself a few minutes later when they had to get their camera away, and for them to see the archer who had hit the deer, show and recover his arrow. There's a lot of that kind of, very peaceful kind of, residual haunting going on. Once you get out of that reservation, the ghost stories seem to be a little darker. Probably the most haunted area of the forest itself is this area known as the Asonet Ledge, which is an old quarry, which seems to be kind of the focal point of a lot of negative energy of the forest itself. There have been more than 15 confirmed, I believe more than that, suicides from jumping from this ledge in the past few years. And by few, I mean about 30 years. Including reports that people have jumped off the ledge after going in with their friends to be, kind of the party place. Hang around with friends in a good mood, and then they were overwhelmed. I actually have interviewed people who have felt that. They go to the Asonet Ledge, they're perfectly fine, they haven't even popped open their first beer, and all of a sudden they're overwhelmed by this feeling of hopelessness, and they've gone to the side, and one person went to the side and had full intentions of jumping before his friends kind of pulled them back. They also believe at the bottom of this quarry, there's a bottomless pit of water like there are in most quarries. They also believe that there's a lot of bodies that are in that body of water that will never get discovered. Because it's too deep, too cold, and too dark. Police divers have kind of called off the search sometimes. Whenever there's someone missing in that area, they always check it, but they can't go that deep. One of the great hauntings from this site, the Asonet Ledge, is the story of the woman in black, or the woman of the ledge, or the lady of the ledge, I should say. And this is a woman who is seen at the very top of the ledge, just all in black. Sometimes she's seen to jump, and before she hits the water, she vanishes. And this has been seen by locals for years, and was seen by a very good friend of mine, who's a fellow investigator, a few years ago, before he knew any of the stories. He saw this woman at the ledge when they were going up there to get a little partying done. And she was kind of off to the left, and he watched her, and he clearly saw the figure of a woman. He turned to his friends to kind of be like, hey, who's that? And she was gone. And he kind of explained this to them. They go, oh, that's the lady of the ledge. He's like, oh, I've never heard of that. And so they kind of told him the whole story, and here's kind of where the urban legend comes in. Well, what happened was, don't you know, the lady of the ledge was supposed to meet her boyfriend at the ledge. And because their families didn't get along, his family held him up. He never got there. And her in her grief of her broken love, jumped from the ledge and committed suicide rather than live without him. So this is a true haunting. This is a person who many people have seen. It's been documented for years, this dark figure, this dark female figure at the top of the ledge. Yet because they can't explain where she came from, because there is no genuine backstory, no real backstory, they come up with an urban legend. They insert a very classic example of an urban legend to make up for it. I mean, this is a story that goes back to Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, and even beyond that. And I've seen this kind of story, this is a backstory for haunting, all across America. Whole romantic idea of...
Exactly.
Romantic idea of two lovers. Right. And not only that, but it makes sense to us. It makes the unknown known, because we know the story so much, and we love to hear it, and we love to hear that, love will kind of... he's forever caught in the lover's leap.
It humanizes the experience that we can't explain.
Exactly. It makes it something that even in death, if for God forbid I were to become a ghost, at least I can be a romantic ghost.
Good one, Chris. I like that.
Well, I mean, you know, there's so few hauntings of, like, here's Joe, who's an accountant. He slipped one day and then passed away. No, it's always, there was a gunfight, there was a violent crime, there was a, and, you know, Ouija boards are great for this kind of thing. There's no one ever comes on a Ouija board during communication and says, hi, my name's Joe. I was walking on the beach, and I led a very long and healthy life until I died. No, it's always, I'm dead, I committed suicide, and I'm buried right underneath where you're sitting right now. You know, go find me. That's, you know, that kind of like seek out Ouija board thing. It's the same thing with hauntings all across the United States and all over the world. But there's a backstory that can draw us in. The story itself perseveres. The story itself becomes more than just a haunting. It becomes almost like a local celebrity.
Huh. Very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I guess a good example of that would be the redheaded hitchhiker of Route 44. Which is on the other end of the triangle in Rehoboth, which I cover in my upcoming book, Ghost of the Victoria Triangle, where this redheaded hitchhiker was seen for decades, and people have genuinely reported having spotted him back in the 1970s, until all of a sudden, because he was written about in this great ghost book, The New England Ghost Files, since then he's become a local celebrity. Everyone who lives in Rehoboth knows the story. They know someone who knows someone who's seen him. And he all of a sudden goes from this very creepy peering in your car. You run over him. He's seen outside your window. He talks to your radio. He takes control of it. These things that people really reported to. Oh, well, now if you go to the town line on 44, you shut off your lights. You honk your horn 3 times. If you turn it on, he's going to be in your light. You know, or if you're driving with 3 people on that stretch of road and you all close your eyes at the same time and you open them, he'll be in the fourth seat. So here's another example of this really kind of famous ghost in that area drawing all of these different urban legends that have to do with roadside ghosts in so that he no longer becomes just what he was, but he becomes this kind of personified and almost kind of super ghost because he's got all these legends.
Well, it's really interesting too, Chris, because that's an urban legend that seems to be universal. I remember I was out in California in the early 1970s, and at the time, you know, around the Big Sur area in San Francisco, they were talking about the hitchhiking ghost out there, who people would pick up. Even I think some rock groups made songs about it, the hitchhiker that would disappear. And of course, we all know the one. I think the story originally took place in Chicago about the young girl who was given a ride and was killed on the way to the dance, and, you know, they find the jacket on the tombstone. So there seems to be elements of all of that incorporated. So that's really fascinating how it disseminates.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things, I'm going to throw a plug in here, one of the things I'm hopefully going to talk about at Paranexus conference is this whole thing that it dates back before cars. It dates back to, you know, Pele, the volcano god of Hawaii. It dates back to a fairy legend of England and of Ireland. It dates back to, you know, Little Red Riding Hood getting off the path and coming across a wolf. These are things, you know, roads especially are these kind of journey places for us. It's where we kind of, we make our bones. We go from one place to another. And they're scary places. And especially if it's dark or it's unfamiliar, or if you start getting into, you know, places where the road gets a little bit, a little bit off civilization, then you start to kind of touch the unknown, and really touching the unknown of whatever past and life you're on. And because of that, all these really good stories have kind of come along and twisted themselves. I remember you talking about the San Francisco area had that great urban legend of the woman who died in the car, and her son was still in the car, and her ghost appeared and was leading people to try to find the son who was still alive in the car. That's another great urban legend with another twist on it. So what happens is, as time passes on, we just kind of take these same stories and we twist them a little bit to kind of serve our purpose.
Very interesting. Fascinating with human psychology.
It is. And, you know, it's funny because I tell my students all the time, there's a classic line, and they get sick of hearing it, but all literature is a representation of the life and time during which it was written. You know, if you want to know what a place area was like, don't look at the history books, look at the literature or the art that was created. It's the same thing for our ghost stories. If you want to know what a place is like, do their ghost stories. I'm, you know, planning on moving to Florida. The first thing I did, I wanted to pick up some ghost. I want to know Florida's urban legends. I want to know their ghost stories because they're really kind of, you get a feel for the people of an area by what they're scared of and the stories that they're telling. And that's kind of the fascinating part. You know, I love going out there with equipment. I love doing investigations. I love the scientific aspect of things and kind of a lot of the new technologies that we're incorporating. But when it comes down to it, to me, it all pales in comparison to the story, to the heart of the haunting, to the way it is affecting people and the way it then kind of changes its impact on people based on how we're perceiving it. That's the stuff that really fascinates me about the paranormal.
Yeah, I'm with you on that because, you know, you look at most of these cases that we investigate, and a goodly majority of them really don't involve paranormal phenomena so much as they do the psychological aspect of what people believe about the paranormal phenomena. And so,
right.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that's the most fascinating part of paranormal research is the psychological aspect and what causes people to believe that they are experiencing paranormal activity when we are hard-pressed to find anything.
Right. It's one of those things where how come we haven't ever really heard of a really good paranormal investigator from Africa or from South America? Because they have a very different relationship with their ghosts. They have a very different feel for what they are. So they know when something is real and when something isn't real because they have a spiritual side to themselves that allows themselves to communicate very freely with the ghosts that are there. You don't hear a lot of debunkers in that area because they take this as an opportunity to kind of touch the other side as opposed to something to go out there and analyze and then overanalyze. So they don't have a lot of fake ghost stories, I guess, in a way.
Hmm.
It's very cultural thing, a very cultural phenomenon depending on where you go. And you're absolutely right, Chris, as to how people view it. And you know, the best example is look at some of the ghost the paranormal research that comes like out of the Philippines or other areas where that's heavily influenced by the culture itself. I remember I've done a little bit of research on near-death experiences, and one time when I was working in a hospital, I asked one of the Indian physicians, I said, you know, have you ever had one of your clients in India tell you that, you know, when I died, I saw Krishna or whoever the Indian god was? And so it was, he said, yeah, it's very specific to culture. So it's really, you can't separate the culture from the cultural beliefs from the people that live in the area. It's really fascinating.
And one of the interesting things, you see how you know, modernization makes those things pile on top of each other. Where I teach in Lawrence has the benefit of being old enough to have gone through several different immigration cycles. So from the original Puritans that settled it to a very, very high Italian and Irish Catholic population of a few decades ago, and now a strong Dominican and Haitian population, how the same ghost stories are arising, the same areas are being called haunted by different people, and yet the way that they're perceiving it, the way they tell the story, is different because their culture itself is different. And it's very interesting to see, you know, my students sometimes say, oh, yeah, here's what I've heard about that place. And then to hear an old-timer talk about that same place, and the haunting, the heart of the haunting is the same, and yet the way it manifests is very different.
See, all in the interpretation, correct?
Right. And it's one of those classic things, yeah, and the Bridgewater Shrine was a great place for this, because when you have these people who traditionally don't get along coming together and interpreting things different ways. So, for example, there are a lot of UFO-type sightings in the Bridgewater Triangle. The ufologist clearly says that's a UFO, whereas someone who studies the paranormal says, that's not, what are you crazy? That's a ghost sight. That means that there's some kind of spirit there. You know, and then, of course, the cryptozoologist is saying, oh, well, no, it's part of this, and it's part of that. And then, of course, you have, you know, the harder, more accepted scientists say you guys are all crazy. It's just, you know, your imagination. And planes. You're near Boston and about 20 other airports. So it's one of those things where same thing, only there's so many different eyes looking there, usually, unfortunately, that don't get along, that are, what it is depends on who you're talking to.
And you know what else is really fascinating about it, Chris, is even though there are cultural differences, it all seems to, over the course of time, kind of become interwoven in there to some degree. And, like you just kind of alluded to, people, depending on their cultural viewpoint, put their own spin on it. So the funny thing about it is, to me, or what strikes me as funny or paradoxical, is here you have all this history of people who are at conflict, and yet in the end, it all seems to kind of be blended so that, it comes out kind of better in the end. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, because I think when you've got different sets of eyes looking on it and different approaches and different people chronicling it with different voices, you're going to get maybe a full picture by getting a lot of little pictures.
Hmm.
A mosaic is still a pretty picture, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well put.
Yeah. That's amazing. I really appreciate this conversation tonight, because this is the kind of stuff, folks, that will expand your horizons as a paranormal researcher of any genre, whether it's parapsychology, cryptozoology, ufology, because when you're investigating the mysterious, the paranormal, most people know you've got to take in the human factor, the psychological factor, because so much of that affects what people think, what they see, what they believe. And this is what's so good about this, is that, people will swear up in one side and down the other that they saw this, that, or the other thing. And the question is, did they? Well, they might have. They might not have. It might have been what some scientists call mass hysteria or cultural conditioning. And that's what the urban legend thing is, right, Chris?
Right. That's definitely one of the aspects of it. It is when people hear something, they don't watch. It becomes kind of part of their explanation or thing. They go, you're surprised how many ghosts, for example, are little children. And I can tell you from having a little child, everything sounds like a little kid laughing or crying. But because there's such a huge electron of child ghost stories, all of a sudden you have this kind of, it's got to be a ghost of a child who somehow lost their life on my property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
That also makes it more sympathetic, too, and it's easier to feel an affinity towards a child who may be helpless as an adult. And that kind of, don't you think that kind of takes the scary edge off of it sometimes?
I think it takes off the scary edge and puts on the creepy edge.
Really?
Most people are sympathetic to a point. The child goes with them and they see the child when it becomes a real haunting. People very often are more freaked out and more disturbed because, it's okay if the ghost is of a criminal who died in that area. But if it's a little kid who did nothing, and let's face it, there is no child death that is not tragic. There is no, he lived a long life and then something happened. Even if it's a disease, which takes 2 years, it's still a child who suffered through that disease. So it becomes not scary, but creepy and unsettling and disturbing in a very different way.
Makes sense. So, Chris, tell me this. I don't know if you've ever looked at this, but in your travels, in your investigations, have you ever come up with a percentage, or do you have a feeling on a percentage of the actual hauntings versus those that are psychologically induced?
I think that, a good percentage to you is about 10% of what people think are bumps in the night, are ghostly bumps in the night, and the rest are just things that, whether it's their imagination or a misunderstanding of their environment, people always ask, and maybe it's different across the country, but people always ask, oh, you must be busiest in October. And I'm busiest in October talking to radio shows or doing book signings, but my busiest time of getting stories actually are the winter months. February and March is the late one, because people aren't used to being in their houses, no matter how long they live there. The weird noises that their houses make are always something that has got to be something otherworldly. A great example of this is Tom D'Agostino. who's a great writer from this area. He's written Haunted Massachusetts and Haunted Rhode Island. He's really kind of an inspiration, someone I work closely with. He tells the story of when he moved into his new house and he thought Sherry had a ghost. Because he kept hearing these very weird noises that were unexplained the same time every night. So as an investigator, you know, in his mind, kind of cooking, you know, residual haunting. And until he found out that his dog, who he'd had for years, was a really heavy snorer. And it wasn't until he moved out of the city and they were in more of a rural setting where he could actually hear the dog snore that he realized that this whole time the dog had never gotten a good night's sleep, but had always been hidden by the traffic going by and things like that. You know, that's an example of not knowing your house and not knowing your environment. And so in the winter months, especially here in the Northeast, you know, pipes creak because they get cold. Mm-hmm. Drafts happen because it's cold outside and the wind blows. And yet in the fall months or the spring months and definitely the summer months, we don't notice these things. We're too busy kind of going on our things. We go out of the house, we come in, it becomes our pit stop being home because we like being outside for the most part. During the winter, we're kind of hauled up. It's almost like an example of The Shining in like little proportion. You know, you almost drive yourself crazy being in your own house. And one of those things, you know, then your floor creaks differently. The windows rattle a little bit differently. Why? Because there are ghosts that just magically come to you in the wintertime? No, what happens is that you're just unfamiliar with all those sounds. But then what happens is, here's where the urban legends come in again, you do a little research and you find out that there was a tragedy in your house that happened during those months. So automatically, these weird things that can be very explained away if you just kind of took a moment to understand your environment, because you've been told that these things happen when ghosts are around, you do research, you find something that might be connected, some weird thing that happened during those months, and, you know, bam, you've got yourself a nice little ghost house.
Interesting. All right, we're coming up at the top of the hour. Very interesting conversation that we've got going on here. And we're going to take a break in a minute, and because Chris was able to do a shameless plug, I want to do a shameless plug, too. That'd be fair. Okay. I just wanted to remind folks that about Paranexus, the conference coming up. Chris did mention that. He's going to be joining us. We're going to have that in October, a week before Halloween, so it's a good prime time. It's going to be in Tampa. We've got a great lineup of speakers. We're going to add some more here shortly in the next few days. But it's a great time to enjoy a well-done conference with some very good topics, topics that will enhance your ability to do research, that will broaden your thinking, expand your mind, and give you the opportunity to network with other investigators, with other researchers, and to benefit from their knowledge and also to share your knowledge. So take a look at paranexus.org. The conference is coming up. You can register now. We'd also love to have you as a member of Paranexus. Right now you can join for charter memberships for $5 for 6 months. We're continuing to add things all the time. We just recently added a Paranexus TV channel that's got some on-demand programs. We're looking for content for that all the time, so you can kind of watch what you want, and we'll continue to add to that. But we're also adding other things. For example, we are launching the International Standards Committee, which is some different seasoned paranormal researchers, and we're going to come up with a set of international standards which groups can adopt, something that kind of unify everybody. And that, of course, that committee is being chaired by Dusty Smith, a long-term investigator from Daytona Beach. So take a look at paranexus.org. We'd love to have you as a member. We'd love to see you at our conference in Tampa this coming October. And there's my shameless plug. Hang with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Welcome back to Paranexus Universe. This is Doug Kelly with my co-host, Grant. Hey, Grant.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
We are talking with our special guest tonight, Chris Balzano. He is a paranormal investigator and author. He's got a book out called Dark Woods, and he's got several other books coming out. He's also been a contributor to Jeff Ballinger's. Am I saying Ballinger? Is that how he says it, pronounces it, Chris?
It's one of the funny things about him is that, you know, he gets about 20 different pronunciations and he takes them all in stride. So I think officially it's Belanger, but he'll answer to just about anything.
Oh, cool. So we've been having a great discussion with you, Chris. I really like the psychological aspect, the cultural aspect of what you've been talking about with regard to the Bridgewater Triangle and some of these urban legends. Now, you have another part of your book that you said is a big part of it. What's that again? You want to talk to us about that?
Sure. It is the influence of these small troll-like creatures called Pukwudgies. And these Pukwudgies are kind of a central figure in, well, you would think first, just by the name and by their appearance and all these other things, they would be things of the past. Pakwajis are these, like I said, small troll things, usually about 2 or 3 feet. There seems to be a few different kind of species of them. Some of them look like a Native American, kind of scorched down and compacted, which I guess would make it, you know, that troll-like appearance. Other ones have been described as looking a little bit more like Elmo, but they have kind of the same general disposition. And these are, originally they were very trickster kind of spirits. They were shift changers who are shapeshifters who would basically make things really hard for the Wampanoags. Although every once in a while they would kind of feel bad for them and help them, but for the most part they would just pull little practical jokes. And they were kind of controlled by this larger creator god called Mashop. And one day Mashop went away because he was lured by a beautiful woman into the sea and all that kind of classic mythology stuff. And when he got back, he found that these Pukwudgies had turned evil. That instead of being tricksters, they were actually becoming very violent. They were burning Wampanoag villages. They were killing Wampanoag braves who were out in the woods. They were kidnapping small babies. All of these really, really horrible things. And so then, you know, a big battle ensues between the Pukwudgies and the giants until the Pukwudgies eventually kind of win over. And these are classic. If you actually follow the history of the Wampanoag, these major shifts in Pukwudgie behavior coincide with all these different things that happened in their history. You know, from the formation of the Cape Cod itself to the arrival of the Native Americans. Because what happened as the arrival of the Puritans. Because what happens is, if you read the old Wampanoag legends, as soon as they start getting converted to Christianity, what you have are these Pukwudgies become kind of foot soldiers of the devil with a capital D. So they then become a representation of evil, kind of the way, you know the devil is in Salem, you know, a few hundred years later, or I should say 100 years later. You have, if something bad happens, it's because of a Pukwudgie. Well, then, you know, classic Christian idea, when you go into a place, don't completely convert them, shift their legend. And so you think it exists as just this urban, not urban legend, but this kind of legend, this folklore type thing. But for the past 5 years, I've been recording multiple Pukwudgie sightings and Pukwudgie attacks. So these Pukwudgies, which seem like they should be out of a storybook, are actually still alive and well in the Freetown State Forest. And people have kind of encountered these, and the ones from Freetown, at least, have never become violent. Mm-hmm. There are two instances where the person kind of almost stumbles along a Pukwudgie. They get freaked out by it. They kind of go away. You know, they disappear. They vanish. They're not there when they look again. And then days and sometimes weeks later, I have one instance of a woman who was sleeping in her bed, and she woke up in the middle of the night and kind of got up, and she was, you know, nervous in her room, and she was fully awake. It wasn't a sleep paralysis kind of situation. And there was the Pukwudgie at the window, kind of looking at her with this look of, just so you know, I know where you live. And then another very similar instance where a man was driving around. He had seen the Pukwudgie, and a few days later was driving around, was parked in a parking lot, kind of stopped, listening to a song, having a cigarette, and in his rearview mirror was the same Pukwudgie he had seen in the forest behind his car, giving him that same kind of look like, you know me, you know who I am, I know who you are.
Was he like pointing his finger with that menacing face like you see on Family Guy, the monkey in the closet dude?
No, that's what makes it so creepy, is that it's according to both separate witnesses, the look is so much more of like blink and kind of knowing without saying anything, that it's kind of like the smile with the corners of the mouth turn up and like, yeah, I know something.
Huh.
You know, so that's in that area, but on the other end of Massachusetts, on the other border, you know, if you just go into New Hampshire, there's Valence Cemetery, where people have actually been physically attacked by these Pukwudgies. So it's this great legend, which ain't a legend. It's something that people are really experiencing, and kind of a, you know, it's very interesting. We're talking about kind of evolution and the different people in different eras and different cultures perceive things. If you read the legends, you find this reference to Taipai Wankas. They are these little flashes of light, which are the souls of Wampanoags. And what the Pukwudgies do, they use these flashes of light to draw people into the woods or to water sources, and then either kill them or drown them. And it's interesting because during the research, you find that they stop using the word Taipaiwunkas and they use the word, and I always get the word arrangement mixed up, but is it Will-o'-the-Wisp or Wisp of the Will, whatever it is,
which
is a classic European example of the word we now call horse.
Or Will-o'-the-Wisp has also been likened to ball lightning.
Right. So it's kind of like every culture has this different, and to actually read the research and connect them through different books, all of a sudden, you know, like, and that's what I experienced when I was in Balin Cemetery before I knew kind of the full lore and the full story on the Pukwudgies. I had just heard about these attacks. And so what happened was we were in that cemetery. It was actually my bachelor party, which goes to tell you what kind of person I am. And we were there for a completely different haunting, trying to document it. And we started to see these flashes of light, and we followed them into the woods until I was, you know, not knowing the whole Pukwudgie aspect of it, said, you know, something's stalking us, something's drawing us into the woods. And so, you know, we kind of made our way back to the cemetery, and then we were inundated by these visible, and I'm not talking, you know, I snap a picture and a whole bunch of dust in the area looks like ghosts. I'm talking about visible, you know, bursts of light which seem to be traveling on their own and like I said, appearing, and then when you get to the place where they were, they appear a little bit further. So these were very kind of, you know, vivid, you know, obviously awake, full-fledged balls of lightning that were kind of traveling in the cemetery. And then we eventually left the cemetery when this large, dark figure appears out of the ground as we were kind of investigating it. You know, it was kind of, okay, that's our time to go. And the large, and that was actually when I first started investigating, so it was that intimidation factor. Well, I'm getting reports of all three things in those locations. People seeing these weird Pukwudgie-type creatures, people seeing these balls of light, and people seeing this darker figure, which acts kind of like a traditional shadow figure, but is a little bit different, so I actually call them dark men. And this kind of coincides with the whole aspect of there was something darker controlling the Pukwudgies, which the Puritans chose to call the devil.
Hmm. Can you reiterate what the Pukwudgies look like or the forms they take?
Sure. The classic example of them would be about between 2 and 3 feet, elongated nose, almost canine nose, and it looks like everything is kind of squished in, so they have a larger belly. They look as if you were to take a Wampanoag, it's a classic Native American, with the nose long and kind of crushed. And so everything is kind of, you know, all those body parts are there, but they're kind of all squished together. The other one is, it's funny because Hollow Hill and the work of Fiona Broom there, she has been documenting these, and she called them Grovers on a Bad Day, like Grover from Sesame Street.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I talked to her, I realized I don't think she has children, because when I asked her, she said, yeah. And I said, well, blue? And she said, well, no, actually red. I said, so you're talking more of like Elmo. And she said, I don't know who Elmo is. So, but basically, so she's always described it as Grover, but it's actually more of like Elmo. So darker red, covered in this kind of fur. And even the ones that look like Wampanoag seem to be covered in the thick hair.
So they, I mean, they're like, they take a bipedal form, human stand up on 2 feet type form, or?
Yep, and this is another one of those things. Are these Pukwudgies unexplained animals? You know what I'm saying? Are they more kind of in the cryptid area? I would say no, only in, I mean, they're not strictly ghosts, although they seem to incorporate ghosts. But because they have this kind of other worldly aspect of them where they can turn into mosquitoes, for example, or they can turn into dogs, for example, or a wolf-like creature, because they've got that aspect to them, they kind of move beyond the realm of a Bigfoot or an unexplained bird. So they're a little outside of cryptid. They incorporate ghosts, so they're really kind of one of those things where within the unknown, they're kind of the unknown as well.
Hmm.
And maybe that's other than the fact that the word Pukwudgie is a really cool-sounding word, maybe other than that, that's why they kind of stick, and people, when they hear about them, want to know more about them, is because they're not traditional, and they're not kind of nailed down to something. Aside from the fact that they still are being seen, you don't know what kind of category to put them in. You don't know, you know, what neat little slot that they go into, and to sort of kind of bleed into all these different aspects of the supernatural and the paranormal.
And that's your feeling? Do you have a place to classify them?
You know, it's kind of, you know, as I get older and I get exposed to more things, it becomes really hard to, you know, obviously it's hard to separate kind of the Christian aspect of it, but to me they almost seem like an elemental.
Hmm.
That can take human form or semi-human form. These pupwudgies, if you're human, you're not going to mistake them for a human.
Hmm.
They seem to take that on because they're, like I said, controlled, seem to be controlled by these watchers who watch what they're doing. They have this other kind of control over the elements. They're able to shift. So they seem kind of like an elemental to me. Or, you know, if you take away any kind of Christian aspect of it, just go by the definition of what an elemental is,
uh-huh.
They seem to fall into that code category the easiest.
Right. When elemental is it's a very British thing, too, or maybe I should say European. It's where it comes from a lot, at least where it started, I believe. I'm not wrong. Okay, so I had a question. These pukwudgies, an elemental, I guess I just had a brain fart here. My question lost me. Okay, so how often are they seen? Or
I think that it's not a common thing. The ones in Valen, for example, people have been attacked by them. You know what I'm saying? The pukwudgies have been an active thing. The other people I've reported in Freetown seem to kind of come across them. I've got a case in Framingham, same kind of thing. The person came across the pukwudgie, almost like they found it in the woods and saw something they shouldn't. Other cases, it's kind of like people are investigating some other aspect of the paranormal, oftentimes in cemeteries, and then they find these pukwudgies there as well. And these darker spirits which seem to kind of be hovering over the whole thing, but not physically, but, you know, psychologically or emotionally. They're all associated with each other.
So do you feel that these pukwudgies are more urban legend, or are they a real phenomena, or both?
I feel that there are real phenomena that, once again, people have applied some kind of legend to. You know, if you can't explain why there's such thick fog on Cape Cod, a spirit who created Cape Cod who likes to smoke a lot. And yet, there's a reason why they're there in the first place is because something weird happened. And so people saw these creatures and created kind of a history for them. And that history changed as the way that they perceived it changed, but then also as they kind of learned more ideas.
So it started out perhaps as a real phenomenon, but then grew in scope because of people's beliefs and the rumors and the stories.
Right. I mean, just imagine for a moment you're jogging in the woods and you come across what can best be described as a gremlin of some type. How do you begin to process that? You know, how do you begin to even find a glossary in your head to cross-reference, to come up with words to describe that? Well, what happens is, you know, you don't. You don't talk about it. And one day you're reading a book and you hear a story about something and you go, that's it. That's what I experienced. It might not be, but it's the closest thing that your brain can kind of connect to.
Sure.
And so all of a sudden people start using that word. I don't think that, you know, pukwudgies are a New England thing. Pukwudgie is the name for this creature in New England. It has different names all across the country and perhaps all across the world. It all has to do with, you know, what people have kind of been told, oh, well, you know what that is? That's a Wendigo. You know what I'm saying? Or
right.
That's a this. And then it's kind of related to that.
Like elemental. And in fact, you know, we refer to elementals quite often as malevolent inhuman spirits, in my essence.
Right.
So are you familiar with any other names that are used regionally?
Like I said, I know Wendigo is used.
Oh.
And I think that's more of a Minnesota type word.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, you know, if I had Darkwoods in front of me, I could run over the whole list of them. But, I mean, there are monsters and creatures that are very much like this that have very similar characteristics all throughout. You know, I think the book of Inhuman Dumidir, so many pieces will talk once more.
What's really interesting about this, fellas, is the fact that here you got an area that's rich in Native American culture. Then you get an infusion of a very restrictive culture from Europe. You've got the blending of these two cultures. And as time goes by, you know, I can see the Native American influence in because the Pugwudgies seem to have some characteristics of shamanism. And it just seems that the whole phenomena, as you so eloquently, you know, point out, Chris, has kind of evolved and morphed into this combination of urban legend and, you know, what may be actual phenomena that's of Native American origin.
Right. It's funny because if I'm talking to a group of paranormal investigators or people who are interested in monsters or things like that, they tell the story completely different. I teach the Pukwudgie legend in the classroom, and I use it as an example of allegory, you know, and an example of you know, where every different phrase represents something else. And that's exactly what you have. You have a real supernatural element of something there, which all these stories just kind of gravitate to and get attached to.
Okay, so if I were a social scientist, cultural anthropologist, psychologist, I might be trying to explain this whole Pukwudgie-related thing in terms of human psychology, right?
Yeah.
I might try to come up with that. Have you explored any of that aspect in terms of, I know you've been talking about it, but just to kind of reiterate it, to kind of boil it down, do you think that there's a big aspect to that? Do you think it could be explained purely with human psychology, with mass hysteria, cultural conditioning?
I think their existence, in my opinion, can't be denied. There are too many stories of direct contact. It's not like it's, and we're talking about, you know, not I saw something out of the corner of my eye or something that I couldn't explain. You're talking someone saw a creature, and they described it very much the same way. The stories attached, I feel, are 100% a representation of who we are. I mean, if you think about it, it even, you know, physically looks like a smaller version of Mr. Hyde, and, you know, our representation of the id. You know, the stories behind it and the characteristics it's given that doesn't actually display, you know, the old stories and the kind of the new stuff that gets attached to it, it's all pure psychological representations of what we think it is and what we need for it to be. But with all that being said, people are still being really scared by them.
So that's a good point real quick that, you know, that it may have its roots in a real phenomena that's perhaps a lot more rare than what the stories would suggest. And so for paranormal researchers, that's something to take into account, right? I mean, when you're if you're a paranormal research group and you've got a similar story, what are the things you need to look at so that you can kind of nail it down and try to figure out what's really happening? You got any suggestions?
Know the legends that are out there. You know these. Know the way that we are influenced by them. Know the way that it that old stories attach themselves to witnesses who kind of then give you a story of what has happened. Know them yourself. You know, we want to, like, do you know what happened here? Well, there's supposedly a haunted hitchhiker there. If you're a paranormal investigator and you're a seeker of truth, you need to have a moment of pause when that happens. You know, you need to say to yourself, wait, and I've heard that story before. A great example of this is the classic urban legend of the busload of children that died because the bus gets hit by a railroad, you know, out of a train.
Mm-hmm.
And now if you go to that same railroad and put your car in neutral, these little children, because they all died, these little angel children will lift your car to safety. They'll push you out of the way. And even to go so far, just if you go there yourself and put talcum powder on your rear bumper, you'll actually get the handprints of little children on your bumper. I've had paranormal investigators who I respect who retell this story as if it's true. And I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Every single state has this story. They all give the origin for it. We as paranormal investigators love the backstory because it makes our job a little bit easier. We're not kind of, you know, wandering in the dark trying to find a needle in a haystack. We know what to look for. Look for little kids, look for buttons. You know, like, and so we're tempted by the same kind of thing that makes these stories appealing to just plain storytellers. So the best way to combat it is to know that these things may be true, or activity may be true, but the stories that are behind them, or the stories that they even create themselves, might be a little bit more fiction, and to know what those stories are, so that when we hear them, little bells go off in our head.
Well, you know, Chris, that brings up an interesting incident, and I know that Doug will recall this. I'm sure as a New Englander, you're familiar with the stories of H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes.
Okay, and you know what the Necronomicon is?
Yes, I do. And I know that reading the Necronomicon is attached to so many haunting in this area. You know, that's what you read. He opened up the Necronomicon and read it.
Well, absolutely, and the point I was going to make is we were on an investigation about a year or so ago, and during the course of the investigation, and we had some really interesting stuff, but one of the people that we were talking to told us that as a teenager they had engaged in the black arts and had practiced the Necronomicon, and you know, the thing that got me was it was absolutely apparent that the person who just made that statement did not know that the Necronomicon was a fictional book.
Right.
They had bought into the urban legend 100% or just assumed what they had heard was absolutely accurate.
And so, of course, it becomes, it becomes written fashion and then kind of bleeds into their understanding of the paranormal.
Right.
Absolutely. And it was a hint, a linchpin to some degree in that individual's belief system.
And it's another really interesting way to kind of approach this is you think of, let's say that 50% of people who use a Ouija board somehow is used because of their subconscious. Okay? So let's say a percentage of it is paranormal, a percentage of it is fooling around, and a percentage is their subconscious moving it because they want to hear a certain thing. It's very interesting because people who use the Ouija board learn things in different stages. So, for example, a person who doesn't know about the goats, you know, you should say goodbye if you're talking to a spirit. Once they learn that, all of a sudden, ghosts always say goodbye to them, you know? Or once they learn that those little corners of the board mean channeling, all of a sudden, every one of the ghosts they encounter wants to channel. This is not because all of a sudden they've become open to the prospect of channeling. It's because their subconscious mind processes the fact that the board does a neat new trick where ghosts will actually talk through me, and so then all of a sudden, their new understanding of the paranormal gets kind of transplanted on the board itself.
Interesting. So you're saying that that the Ouija board is really driven from the person's subconscious beliefs?
I'd say a large portion of it is. I mean, you and I have talked about this. I've come around to a different outlook on the Ouija board. I don't want to think it's the tool of all things evil in this world. I do think in the right hands it can be an effective spirit communicator, but I believe the majority of what we're getting is fooling around by the people that are using it or their subconscious. And then there's a portion of it which is genuine spirit communication.
Right, the ideomotor effect.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have preconceived notions too. You know, buying into the folklore surrounding the Ouija board. And depending on what background, what religious background they have, I mean, some religious groups, the minute you pick up the Ouija board, you go in the same room with the Ouija board, you're opening a vortex straight to hell.
Right. And it's a very interesting, you know, once again, all Ouija board stories are a representation of the life and times during which they happen. I mean, it really is. And I think the pendulum is kind of swinging the other way on it to some degree because it's kind of this backlash from New Fed, which is all paranormal is demonic. And so what you're seeing is for a long time, a lot of investigators were not, wouldn't even go in the same room as the Ouija board. And now I kind of think to a small degree, especially as we start to get bored with all these TV broadcasters telling us that everything has to be demonic, as we react to that, we're going to find that more people are going to kind of at least look at the Ouija board as an option or something which, you know, not to automatically dismiss.
I appreciate that because, you know, as we've been saying, I've been saying all along, you know, so many paranormal investigators basically run from Ouija boards, you know, just say no to Ouija boards. We don't use Ouija boards. That's fine. You don't have to use a Ouija board in investigations. They say all these things. They're so afraid of these things, they'll open up channels, as Grant says, straight to hell. And yet they don't realize that every single time they turn on a digital recorder and say, are there any spirits or who want to communicate, they are, in fact, doing the same thing as a Ouija board or a seance. It's the same thing.
It's a digital Ouija board.
Oftentimes you hear this, dude, what are you crazy? You would never actually use a Ouija board? But you know, like people come obsessed with that, and you use it all the time. We spend hours doing it. And that's always told me by some EVP technician who looks like they haven't slept in 3 days.
That's funny. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Chris Balzano. In Urban Legends, great discussion, Chris. We appreciate everything you're offering. So hang tough with us. We'll be back in just a sec.
Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
shadows. In the sky, it's Paranex's universe. Darkness follows.
Hey, welcome back. This is Doug Kelly with my co-host, Grant Rubendass. We have our special guest, Chris Balzano. We're talking about urban legends. We've been talking about a number of great things, very, very interesting things. And there is a question, Chris, I wanted to get out of the way. We were talking about Pukwudgies. And the question is, how tall are they supposed to be?
They seem to be, the reports say that they are between 2 and 3 feet. So I guess imagine they're about the height of a 4 or 5 year old, maybe a little bit smaller than that.
Okay. And you have a picture of them on your website, apparently.
The picture that I have is a picture from, oddly enough, there are really two books, other than my books, there are two books which are really kind of preserving the story of the Puck legend. One is The Narrow Land, which are all these really great folk tales from Cape Cod. And the other one is a children's book. And they're the only two literary references that are kind of still out there, and so, you know, you can get them somewhere, of Puck legend. So it's very interesting that, you know, one of the great resources of Pukwudgie lore is a kid's book. It's a book that I actually, maybe because I'm a little bit twisted, sit down with my 3-year-old and read. When my son sees a picture of a troll in a different kind of storybook, he says, "Yes, Pukwudgie." So it's very interesting that that's kind of the source. I also have a representation drawn by one of the students of mine when I explained the stories, which is actually in the book. It's not on my website, but it's in the Ghost of the Bridgewater Triangle book that's going to be coming out. A very different perspective on what a Pukwudgie looks like. It was kind of her preparing these stories, envisioned in her kind of dreams or nightmares of what this thing would look like. And it looks, once again, very much like a person, a little bit more like a person than the picture that you see in the book there. The book is actually the good, giant, mad Pukwudgie. It looks a little bit more human-esque, and because of that, maybe even a little bit more creepy, a little bit creepier.
Hmm.
Hey, Chris, with all that in mind, what we've discussed over the last hour and a half or so, tell us a little bit, or tell our audience a little bit about, on all the investigations that you've done, like most investigators, I'm sure the bulk of them have not been anything that we would call paranormally significant. And in your investigations, how many cases would you say you've had that you would say have been paranormally significant, and can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. I would probably say, of all the investigations that I've gone on, so this is more than just saying the story of a place, actually going out and conducting some type of investigation, usually 2 or 3. I'd probably say I have a good dozen or so of the, you know, probably, you know, 60 or 70 that I've gone and physically investigated. I would probably say I have about a dozen or so that I think are unexplainable enough to make me have to go that next level of saying, all right, there has to be something paranormal going on here, or at least something unexplained. You know, paranormal investigating is not about taking what is the paranormal and proving it not the paranormal, in my opinion. Instead, it's taking, you know, like a large piece of stone and cracking away all that is not paranormal. So I hate the word debunk. I don't like to go out and debunk something personally. Instead, what I'd like to do is slice away all of an investigation that is, can be explained away, and then you're kind of left with this, you know, little gem that might be something that kind of falls into what we call a ghost or a spirit or any of those things. One of the more interesting stories, and kind of another different aspect of the urban legend aspect of things, would be I got a call for an investigation in this place called the Cushnet, which is technically, you know, I believe actually used to be part of Freetown. And so what it is they called me up and they said, we have all these weird things going on. You know, we hear these children laughing. We hear, you know, these running up and down the stairs. Can you come in and investigate? And I was like, sure, no problem. Now, as soon as I got there, what I realized was this couple that lived there, not only was it a complete emotional, you know, fire pot. In other words, there's a lot of tension in the house. There was tension between, you know, the family and the mother that used to live there. There was tension, not tension, but there was at least a lot of emotion going on. A couple that was there was pregnant. Another couple that was there was just getting married, so there was a lot of anxiety. It was kind of a non-traditional family, so there were a lot of different kids going in and out of the house, stepkids and things like that. All these kind of this breeding grounds for things that are unexplained that can be explained away. The other thing I found, and you asked earlier, kind of like the, well, how we're an investigator, what can we do with this knowledge of urban legends? Part of this urban legend is what we're currently being said by the media. In other words, words like debunk or manifestation, buzzwords that we hear from witnesses that basically mean you've watched a lot of Ghost Hunter episodes, right? And so what you have to do is you have to kind of put that in the back of your mind as these are people who are well-versed in one aspect of the paranormal. So when something happens, what actually they're doing is they're processing it through media eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So they see their haunting as something that they've seen on television. And so when they retell the story, they tell the story that best fits what they've seen because they feel that's what investigators want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into this house with a lot of like, well, we're going to see what happens. We're going to see what happens. And this has to be in a non-scary way, in a non-intimidating way, the most active house that I've ever been in.
Mm.
In other words, there was nothing about the house. There's nothing about the house that would make me want to never go there. As a matter of fact, I'm going there tomorrow for a barbecue with my family. It's not a scary place, but it is the most active place. I went in there with Matt Moniz, who's part of the Spooky South Coast crew, and Mike's and we got some of the tightest evidence I've ever heard in my life. The first time I went in there, and this is kind of, I was just reviewing this for I was trying to take pictures of this EVP, like, visually on the screen. We went in there, and the very first thing I said was, do you know any of us? Now, I, at the point when I first investigated this, was, a beginner at EVP technology and of getting them. I brought this evidence to my school because I was actually having a paranormal investigation class in, with my high school.
Mm.
The Matthew that I get after that is so loud that my 14-year-old and 15-year-olds are all like, what? I just heard someone say something. Someone just said Matthew. The evidence was that clear. The second time we went in, and here's kind of where it takes this new twist on the paranormal. The second time we went in, Mike Markley, except his name, set up 10 high-end, he's an EVP man, like, through the bone. He set up these 10 high-powered microphones, processed all through kind of the same system.
Hmm.
Not only did we pick up the strongest EVPs I've ever heard, we picked up EVPs that basically explain, to some degree, a paranormal hierarchy. In other words, different levels of spirits. For example, some spirits are talking to us, and they can't see us, but they can hear us. Then they relate to other ghosts asking what we're doing. Then other ghosts are telling them to be quiet. You don't want them to hear you. I mean, these kind of conversations going through what seem to be different levels of ghosts that kind of point at this, wait a minute. We like to think of ghosts as, once again, on the spectrum of being a certain thing. And these EVPs and this evidence that we gave, all of which was sparked by they watched Ghost Hunters and heard noises in their attic, it kind of points to this really odd level of intelligence and level of consciousness of spirits which might be in this house. Some of them were individual. Some of them were, it would appear, kind of like low level. They didn't know the quote-unquote rules of being a ghost, such as revealing yourself, or kind of points at that kind of thing. And some of them are very forceful. Hey, shut up. Stop talking. They're recording us. And so it was very interesting when you got all that evidence and sat down with it and then what do you tell the family about that? not only is your house haunted, but there's about 20 different spirits which we captured on tape. So it's very interesting. And then, once again, like I said, going into it, they had a retirement community behind them. So they, once again, recalled that whole, dead people because people next to them were always dying, and this their house being a way station. And on top of it all, the house used to be a funeral home. So they had this and that's what I call the it's got to be haunted aspect of things. If you're in an asylum, it has to be haunted because it's scary looking. There's not a bridge in New England by law that doesn't have a ghost attached to it, right? Because it's supposed to be haunted.
Right.
So this house was another one of those places that was supposed to be haunted because it was a funeral home.
But in this case, it seemed to be? Is that what you were guessing?
It is 100%. Maybe this will kind of be like a little cliffhanger. You have to buy the Ghost of Bridgewater Triangle book to get the rest of the evidence. But we got some pretty insane things that happened there.
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting concept that you bring up. It's got to be haunted. You know, I was just in Cincinnati doing a corporate training program for managers and leaders and coaches, and I just got back today. And I spent two evenings in a house that was, 107 years old. And I stayed with a friend there, and she was wondering, oh, gosh, the house is so old. I wonder if there's anything here. She's never really experienced anything, but you think, you know, I was even telling her, well, it's 100 years old. Let's check it out. You know, we couldn't find anything. I mean, we got nothing. And that's one of those things. Yeah, it's 100 years old. It's got to be haunted, right? No, probably.
Right. I don't want to spoil the surprise, but I'll do it for your listening audience. But in talking about, you know, that exposure aspect, you have the school that I'm at. The school that I'm at right now, it's new. They're just graduating our first class of seniors next weekend. But the building itself is old. It used to be a school. It used to be an all-girl Catholic school in Lawrence, Mass. So when we reopened it, the story kind of began to circulate about this young Dominican girl who had been there some years ago. Okay, your alarm should automatically go off. If I can't tell you when it happened, I just say some years ago, urban legend beginning to happen, right?
Right.
And supposedly she had been there. Her parents were kind of like, you know, neglectful. She used to go here because there was a convent there, and she used to hang out with the nuns. And one day she went there, and they were all at retreat. So she decided to stay at the school, stay at the convent, because she didn't really want to go home, and she really loved the place. And a rainstorm began. So she went to the top of the, she went onto the roof to basically watch a lightning storm. But what happened was she ended up flipping off the roof, caught her hair in kind of the ironwork up there, and hung there, basically, until she asphyxiated. And her scream could be heard all throughout the morning, so she hung from the ceiling, but no one could find her. No one could find where the screams were coming from. And this is a story that my students knew even before I got there. They simply found that I just did the paranormal, they didn't even tell me about it. And supposedly, people have seen a shadowy figure up top in that area. There's a report of someone seeing a pendulum kind of fall down the stairs. There's a report of from one of the people who used to work there late of hearing banging and of hearing screaming. And so running this paranormal investigating class, we went up there and we investigated. And we got orbs, we got Raj, we got EVP of someone in Spanish saying, please help me. All this stuff, which I found really amazing because the English teacher invented the whole thing.
Oh,
there
really?
Is no Maria. There is no ghost there. There is no woman who hung herself. She just felt that it being a new school, it had to have a ghost because you can't have a high school that's not haunted.
So how do you attribute then all the stuff that was gained from that? All the evidence, quote unquote?
I think it's all an example of during the EVP evaluation of us wanting to hear something, and so making what was just rattling or something make more sense than it was. I attribute the orbs to it being a place in the school that we never go to, so just being up there takes up enough dust to give us old owl allergies for the rest of our lives. Same thing with the rod. But what happened is because there's that backstory, because there's a really great story attached to it, and, by the way, all schools have to be haunted officially, we wanted to find ghosts, and so me knowing that the story was fake, I kind of took a detached approach to it. My students found ghosts. They were looking for them. And guess what? If you're looking for a ghost, and
you're going to find them.
You're going to find them.
That's
so it talks about the power of preconception or, you know, preconceived notions about what you're going to find. And that applies to any form of research.
Right. It's the witness, it's the researcher, it's the witness effect on things. You know, there's no way to ever have a truly controlled environment or experiment because we always, as the person who's observing it, bring our way to it.
That's true.
Influence the outcome.
Right. And can potentially think of random number generators. That's all based on the person who's taking the research you believe that your subject can influence it, then what's to stop you from using your PK to influence it as well?
And that's why it's so important for paranormal researchers to go in as neutral as possible. And I understand that in the grand scheme of things, we all take in our stuff, like you say, our weight, and that's a good term. But for paranormal researchers, you've got to go in neutral, you know, not one way or another. See what you come up with. And that's one of the reasons why we don't do research before a case, because we want to go in without any of that weight.
Without any preconceived notions. Yeah, not the way that I do things, but I completely see that side of it, yes.
Well, not everybody agrees, and that's fine. I mean, people do their research, or one of them, like the researcher, may do the research but not share it with anybody, and that's fine, too. It's just whatever the groups want to do. But we don't do it, the research, and if anybody does, it's always one person who does it, and they're the only one who knows before we go in. So that's
the idea of not contaminating any of our, if we're using psychics, or contaminate any of our researchers.
Yeah,
with background knowledge that they could even subconsciously pick up as evidence, or what they perceived to be as evidence.
Yeah, it's funny. I went out a few weekends ago to the Asana Ledge because the New England Ghost Chronicles, or the New England Ghost Story, the New England Ghost Group, or the New England Ghost Project, wanted to do some stuff. So I'm like, well, let's go to the Asana Ledge. You know, if anything, it looks good visually, you know what I'm saying? It would be kind of a good investigation. I was looking to taste them because part of my upcoming books is a DVD on how to kind of do some of this stuff. So we went out there, and I, you know, kind of in my pre-interview with them, told them all about, you know, my Pukwudgie story and what was going on there. And it was funny because every little wrinkle of the water, they were like, hey, remember the Pukwudgie story when they like water? That's a Pukwudgie. So I feel that group definitely, when we were out there, and including the psychic that we used on that investigation, were completely influenced by the fact that, you know, they knew a lot about Pukwudgie war, sure, from me. Which was actually interesting for me because then I was almost observing them doing their investigation with that in mind.
Good opportunity.
Right. And there was a perfect, you know, little enclosed in an area that can't be enclosed experiment on how much I can take to paranormal investigations.
Hmm. Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating. Okay, well, tell us about your book. Tell us about your upcoming books, about your website, and so forth. Another opportunity for a shameless plug.
Shameless plug. I have plugged away. I am Dark Woods, Cult Crime of the Paranormal, which is kind of a lot of what we talked about tonight. That book can be purchased on my website, or through my website, I should say, at www.masscrossroads.com, which is actually a very interesting place to go to see some classic urban legends, to see some kind of some hauntings that are in Massachusetts and New England beyond. You might be surprised at how similar they are to certain ghosts in your area. I think the urban legend section is a really interesting place to go into because they get into a lot that starts from Massachusetts and then kind of, or has a Massachusetts twist to it, but which you're hearing in your neck of the woods as well. And on there, you can also kind of pre-order. I've got three other books coming out this year. In August, I have Ghostly Adventures, which you can pre-order from my website, which is kind of ghost stories from all across America, which was cool because I started to see patterns in different areas of the country, the way that they viewed their ghosts. Ghost of the Bridgewater Triangle is coming out in August. That's kind of more ghost stories from this really weird area of Massachusetts and kind of some of the same connections we've been talking about tonight. And then in September, the Picture Yourself Ghost Hunting book comes out, and this is, as far as I know, the first how-to guide, which kind of falls into that whole idiot or dummy guide. This is a kind of another one of those series. You know, they've got Picture Yourself Drumming and Picture Yourself Ice Skating, and so now they've got Picture Yourself Ghost Hunting. So it's filled with helpful tips. It's filled with stories of failures and stories of successes. How to do this, to kind of talk a lot about some of the new technologies in spirit communication, like the Mini Boss and the Shack Hack and Frank's Boss, things like that. And so it's a really interesting thing. So hopefully, you know, in October, if you're looking to give the paranormal enthusiast, you can give them the entire Bulbana library. You know,
Cool.
Someday Wade told us a package. So
excellent.
Yeah, so where are you going to be speaking? I mean, this.
I am doing a, if you're in this area, New Hampshire or Massachusetts, on the 3rd or the 9th, I believe, I'm coming on. Dining with the Dead from the Haunted Wyndham, the restaurant, which we've been in New Hampshire. And then after that, it's kind of up in the air. I know I'm going to be at the Paranetness Conference in October.
Yeah.
I don't fly back up here for the 3rd annual Monster Mash, which is Mass Monster Mash, which is an event that I kind of co-host here in Massachusetts. They got to come back every year for that. Other than that, I'm kind of, you know, as this whole move is going on, I'm kind of laying low for the majority of the summer. But come fall and come holiday season, by holiday I mean Halloween season, hopefully you'll be able to see me somewhere near you.
Cool. Well, you'll be able to see Chris at Paranexus Conference in October in Tampa. And we invite everyone to take a look at Paranexus.org. Come on and join us. It's a professional association of parapsychologists, paranormal researchers, cryptozoologists, ufologists, trying to bring everybody together and giving folks an opportunity to not only share data, but to comment on things. It's growing. We're getting more stuff added to it. And the conference is going to be a great, great time. It's going to be an exciting time because we've got a good lineup of workshops. We're going to add a couple more here very soon. But we've also got some fun things planned. Thursday night, we're going to have several things going on. We've got a table tipping seance scheduled for midnight on Thursday. We've got Captain Jack from Paranormal Radio going to be a special guest. Of course, Dusty Smith is going to be there. She's going to be showing her episode of A Haunting in Florida and then commenting on some of the stuff that wasn't in the show based on her book, The Dead and Dread and the Dead Filled the Dunham House.
There you go.
Interesting book. Yeah, so she's going to be talking about that. We've got some other potential guests lined up, still waiting to hear back from them. Friday night, we've got the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams are going to go into a purportedly top-secret haunted location. We're going to broadcast that live back to the group. You can even apply to be part of the Paranexus Challenge. There's no additional cost for that. Then Saturday night, we've got the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. That's where we've done our educating. We've learned some things. We've met some people. We've made new friendships. And now we have an opportunity to just have some enjoyable fun. So we've got that scheduled, a lot of neat things. I hope that you will take a look at Paranexus.org and register for the conference coming up in October. Take advantage of the early bird rates. So we've had a great show tonight. Chris, thank you so much for coming on. Still with us, Chris?
I'm still with you.
Yeah,
thank you very much for having me on, man.
And Grant, as always, it's great. Everybody, thanks for listening. Take care. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.